always like very much like, and the phagocytes attack the phagocytes attack the pathogens and destroy them with their blah blah blah. So yeah, and so we were just talking about how basically you need to, in the end, like, we really just want students to learn for their own sake, but like that doesn't always, as you know, students aren't always motivated to learn for the, for its own sake. They need the grade or they need something else, right?
Right.
So yeah, so it's a problem but also a solution. It helped me to think about the idea that like at times I just need to be okay with the fact that like I just need these kids to learn it for its own sake. I can't always show them like how biology or whatever is going to help them, or geometry or whatever is going to help them in their future. Sometimes it just has to be for the sake of learning, and you just have to get energized about it and passionate, even if like you're not necessarily passionate about it. Like you just need to
pretend to be
teach like a pirate.
Arr. Just
pretend to be excited about everything. Yeah, anyways, so I wanted to start also by talking about from 2 weeks ago with the hashtag thing. Did you ever do anything with hashtags over the last 2 weeks in your class, or not really?
I did, and I did tweets as well.
And how did that Twitter go?
The Twitter went a little bit better than the hashtags. For some reason, the kids let me know that they don't like tweeting, that they don't tweet for a reason. They don't use Twitter for a reason. But we still went with it. They actually did pretty good. The way I did it is I just gave them a piece of paper with 140 little lines that they could write a character in.
Yeah.
And it went pretty good. The principal really liked it.
Oh, cool. So I'm trying to understand. So they had like a little paper with 140 lines and they could write, like, what were you having them write?
Well, since we're reading the book, like, Water for Chocolate, they just have to write, like, what was the main idea?
I see.
So it really worked well for that. Then some of the kids wanted to do like a reaction to the chapter. So they did that with their tweets. Other kids just kind of summarized the chapter.
I see. Mm-hmm. And so did any of the kids have trouble staying within the 140? Like, do they want to do more, or was that not really a problem?
Some wanted to do more, some wanted to do less. Some did it actually, they did a great job in less than 140. So it was really interesting to see the different levels.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah.
My other question was going to be, did you have, like, for the kids that couldn't keep it to less than 140, did you work at all on like revising and how to be less wordy or anything like that?
Yeah, like we would talk about so how important is that piece in there that doesn't really matter to the chapter?
Yeah.
So they were like, well, it doesn't really matter, so why should I include it? So it really, really, really helped them a lot with just the main idea. What was the main idea?
Is it something that you would do again, you think?
I think I would.
Cool.
I think it works for English really well. Well, and then maybe for other classes, like, you can make it like the ticket out of class, like what you learned today in the tweet.
Yeah.
That's what I learned at the end too.
For my class, we did, I'll put a picture up of it sometime that I sent. I sent Ernesto a picture of what I did in the iMessage.
That was really, I showed that to my principal, and he was like, I showed that to my principal, the picture. And he goes, wow, that's really amazing. That's really creative. So he really liked that too.
So he's gonna hire me now? No, I'm just kidding. No, but like, so I had kids at the beginning of class one day. I think it was for, well, I did it for a few things. I didn't send you all of them. I think I did one for antigens. And like antigens are, an antigen is like the tag on the end of a cell to let you know whether it's foreign or domestic, whether it's like a virus or not. And so T cells attach to it. And so like I had students do that for that, and also for phagocytes. And phagocytes are the things that swallow the viruses. And I said, okay, guys, come up with five hashtags for a phagocyte or for an antigen. I forget. I think I did it for both. And so, like, for a phagocyte, some kids wrote, like, totally engulfed, because we had talked about what engulf means and how it means, like, a tidal wave crashing over someone. And just, like, a tidal wave crashes over someone, a phagocyte crashes over a virus and basically swallows it. And so I had kids writing things like totally engulfed, or, like, engulfed like a Big Mac, or I don't know, just stuff like that. Like, that they were, like, applying it to things that they understood. And I think they liked it because, I don't know, because they like Twitter. Well, I don't even know if they like Twitter.
They like hashtagging.
Yeah.
Because they do it on, like, a lot of it on Instagram.
Yeah, whether it's, like, Facebook or Instagram or whatever, it seems like hashtags have become
the new thing,
a part of their language or whatever. And so, like, the problem I had was some of them would write, like, YOLO or, like,
yeah,
or
yeah,
hashtag LOL or hashtag, I don't know. And they kind of missed the point, and I had to redirect them to try and get them back on task. And so there was that. Did you have any problems with that or not really? I guess you weren't really doing hashtags, were you?
I did it a little bit. Some of the kids hated it. They're like, I hate hashtags. And the kids said, I don't even know what a hashtag is. So it's like, okay, we'll just work it out a little bit. So, like, when we make lists in class, like, for, like, synonyms or whatever, or when we're talking about a topic and they're just giving me ideas,
yeah,
we just hashtag that.
Hashtag it out?
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting idea, and I think I'm going to pursue it further. I don't know how much I'm going to pursue it further, but because a lot often, as well, as good as it is to, like, relate to them, I also want them to be able to write the full sentences and be able to use proper grammar standard grammar. So I don't know how much I would want to do it all the time, but it is a good exercise, maybe as a ticket out of class or a warm up. Cause I mostly honestly did it as a warm up. For the first 5 minutes of class, I have to have them doing something while I take roll and while kids come in tardy and all that stuff. So, like, I think it's a good activity as a warm up. Or a, like you said, a ticket out of class.
Yeah, I agree with you. I did it as a warm up only.
Yeah, so.
Warm up, yeah. Not as a complete assignment, no. I did think about it, and the principal really thought about it too. And he said that maybe the Twitter, the whole tweet can lead into a paragraph, because my kids hate writing paragraphs.
Yeah.
So if they just put their ideas down in a tweet, and then you combine all the tweets together, then that's a good paragraph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Well, I literally have, I kind of went overboard this week, Ernesto, to be honest. I have like 6 pages of notes that I could talk about, of things that I've just thought of talking about. And we'll just see how far we get, I guess. And I'm going to I'll ask you questions about what I'm saying.
Okay.
And as such, so.
So you said innovation, right?
Innovation, like, as a sort of overarching theme.
Okay.
Because I read a lot of stuff about innovation this week.
Okay, yeah. Well,
go ahead.
I have a question, innovation, because I was doing some reading this morning, and it said that a lot of the article said innovation does not equal technology.
I read, oh my God, I don't know if I'm going to be able to find this article. It was in Slate Magazine. I'm going to search for it later. I'm going to write a note to myself to try and find it later. But it was in Slate Magazine, and it was this article about this guy who is a math teacher who still uses chalkboards. And his, like, standardized test scores are still really high. And it's all pretty much like he just does what he's always done. And he doesn't use any technology, but I guess his kids still do really well. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Did you read anything like that? I'll try to find that article. I'm sorry, I kind of interrupted you.
No, because I was like, okay. So when I thought of innovation, I said, oh, so it's bringing new things into the classroom. And right now the new thing is technology, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, that sounds interesting. But then I'm reading an article and it says, well, innovation is not necessarily technology. You can use technology to be innovative, but innovation is not the same thing as using technology in a classroom.
Yeah.
So do you agree?
I agree. Yes. because I think that innovation can happen in a lot of different ways. And I think innovation is more so an idea than a thing. Like, innovation is this idea that you have to try something that hasn't been tried before. It's like a novel idea. Like, it hasn't been done before, and you think it might work in class. And I think there is some danger of innovating for innovation's sake when it's not really broken, so why fix it? But at the same time, I think that technology is not the only way to innovate. I think there can be ideas in all sorts of ways, even if you're just talking about innovative classroom arrangements, like how you arrange your classroom, or even where you have your class. Maybe you have a class outside one day. Maybe you have your class in the hall for some weird reason because you're doing some kind of lab that requires you to go in the hallway. I think there's all kinds of ways to innovate. Do you agree?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense, because what I want to do is I want to clarify innovation, because I think there might be a lot of confusion. So innovation is just bringing new ideas that have never been done before in order to make your classroom maybe more engaging.
Yeah.
Okay. That are not necessarily tied to technology.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like that you clarified that for me. That's a good point. So we watched this video. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And it's a video about, it's this podcaster. His name's escaping me right now. I'll put it in the show notes. But he was talking to the founder of Atari. And while, like, I don't agree with everything the guy said, I think he said some especially interesting things. And this might seem off topic, but were you listening when he talked about how he was talking about, like, Google versus Apple?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was an interesting, because everyone has kind of their opinion of Google and Apple. I don't know who's better, who's worse. I don't know. What do you think of that whole debate?
I'm not in it. I just do what I just use what I have and whatever I'm introduced to.
You use whatever you're
pretty much
it. To.
Yes. Well, so hey, this is Google Docs. I might just start using Google Docs. You know?
Well, I'll introduce you to the debate. He said that he thought Google was better than Apple because Google's more innovative.
Yeah, because Apple's always just sitting there picking their nose. That's what he said, right?
I think so, anyways.
Yeah.
It's funny because he's the guy, he hired Steve Jobs. As an employee of Atari. So it's interesting that he's sort of changed his tone and thinks that Google's the innovator now. And I'm going to link to a post by Gruber. He's some people think he's kind of an Apple fanboy because he is always sort of defending Apple. But he also makes some good points where he says, like, email was around before Google. They didn't invent email. They just made it better. Because, I mean, like, when I was first introduced to the computers way back in, remember DOS?
Mm-mm.
No? Mm-mm. The blue, it just pops up to the blue screen. Well, my dad had one of those computers when I was little, and it was had, like, Keen the Commander. Oh, I have to find all these old games. But anyways, it was back when you had to, you know, the modem. I don't even know if kids know what a modem is anymore, but you had to connect it to your telephone line, and instead of to, like, the DSL, which is standard now. And, like, I used Juno email, and, like,
Juno, yeah.
Yeah, it was like it was before Google, and Google just happened to make it better. And, like, Google didn't invent you know how, like, Chrome's all the rage now, that browser? Well, they didn't invent browsers, he said. And, like, he also talked about, like, search. Well, can you say Alta Vista? Because, I mean, Alta Vista was around before Google search was around. And he also made the point that, like, Google Plus, that was basically stolen from Facebook. And some people would argue, and I'm not going to I'm not going to stake my claim in the ground. I'm not really on either side either. But Android, which is a Google implementation, was people like Jobs would argue that, well, he would have if he still, but he's not alive, but would have argued that Android was stolen from the iPhone, iOS sort of architecture. And so, like, in that sense, maybe Google's not that innovative. I don't know. But
they're just creative.
But they're really good at taking something that's good and making it great. And so, like, that's where I would say that Google maybe beats Apple, is that they are good at coming into any field, and they hire all this great talent, and, like, this is such a rabbit trail from education, but they hire all this great talent, And I think that it's that development of those great things that really makes them stand out. But if I were to put a stake in the ground about education based on this guy's video, I would say that iOS beats, like, the Apple system beats Android for maybe education, although Google's trying to get into it. Did you know that Google just had their big year-long they had their little yearly conference thing recently. It's called I/O. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Well, it's this thing where so Google is trying to get into education. They were talking a lot about it at this conference thing. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But I don't know that Google or Android's going to make a big dent in education. I mean, they might. I think they will. But at the same time, I think that Android, maybe the difference between Android and iOS is that there's so much more customization that you can put in an Android. And while that's good for people who really, really want their phone to do all these different random things that are, like, good for power users, I don't know. For education, I feel like it's good just to have a few simple apps that all the students can use and that, does that make sense? Like, it's better just to have a few things that work well rather than having 100 million things that are customizable, but maybe all those 100 million things weren't, like, maybe not all the bugs and kinks weren't worked out. And I think that a teacher wants something where there's 5 or 6 things they can use in a class daily, but at the same time, it doesn't break on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of goes back to, like, that Walt Disney thing of, Disneyland, if you go there, like, have you ever noticed, like, there are certain ways that you travel through Disneyland. Like, there's not 100 million different ways to get around Disneyland. You basically have to follow a few certain paths.
Yeah.
And if you've ever been at a parade at Disneyland, they literally direct traffic to go only one way. And they never tell anyone individually, like, you're going the wrong way, but they have so many people out there with those little lava lamp, whatever. What are those things called? Those little lamps that, and they direct them to where they need to go. And it goes back to this. This is, I'm not sure if this is true. This is the only thing I've heard about Disneyland. There's two things that I've heard about Walt Disney, about his sort of philosophy. And these things might be total folklore. I'm not sure at all. But his first one was no chipped ponies, because I guess one time, according to legend, he was watching the carousel and he noticed that certain kids weren't going on certain ponies on the carousel. And he thought it was because, when he went up to examine those particular ones, he noticed they had a lot of chip paint on them. And so he said every child should have a good pony, so to speak. And I think that that can apply to education in the same way that Apple can apply to education, in the way that, like, every single thing that we make has to be awesome and good. Whether it's the school environment, like the cleanliness, like the school food, or the way the staff dresses, or the way the student dresses, or the way, or the state of the hallways, or whatever it is, or, like, our classroom environments, how clean it is, free of dust, like the floors are clean, we have technology, we have big windows. I think sometimes we underestimate the power of big windows for kids to be, I know we sometimes think it's a distraction, and it is, but sometimes it's nice so that school doesn't seem like a prison to have those big windows that kids can look out of. I have a really good view in my room because we're on the second floor, and I have lots of cool windows, but or just, like, the environment. And his second thing was the line should never stop moving, because to keep the illusion going, if people are stopped, they start to get annoyed. And I think that that can apply to education too, in the sense that, like, we need to have good transitions so that we're not ever stopping class and kids are kind of just twiddling their thumbs.
Right.
I don't know. So those are, like, kind of the two things. That was sort of a long, oblique way into like, I was trying to sort of move it back into education. It's this idea that, like, we need to look at every aspect of education, and innovation has to look at every aspect of, I don't know, education. What's your thoughts on this? Any thoughts?
Well, it's true. You know, with those analogies that you just used, the no chip ponies and the light should never stop moving, it applies to education, I don't know, very, very precisely. Because, yeah, we should always have something that's good. And, you know, transitions should be smooth. They should be just good.
And it's hard.
It is. Very hard.
Because every time you have a transition, there is that there is that aspect. If you don't have the metaphorical 500 people telling you which way to go, it can create a, I mean, because even though they have all those people, there are still people that go against the flow. If you've ever been to like the Disneyland fireworks show, there are people that like go the opposite way and fight the flow of traffic. But if you have those 500 metaphorical people telling you which way to go, it works. The problem is getting those 500 metaphorical people to all be on the same page and do the same thing, whether that's like the aides in your class or whether that's you being able to get to every student. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and I think that also with the no chip ponies and the no, and keeping the lines moving and the sort of like Apple, the sort of Appleized idea of like, we should have a few things and do it well. I was listening to this podcast called The Incomparable, which is on the 5x5 network, which is actually a really good podcast network if anyone wants to listen to them. They were talking about the book A Wrinkle in Time. Do you guys ever read that in class?
I've read it before, yeah.
Well, I read it when I was younger. I don't remember the plot. And so I was listening to the podcast and it was sort of reminding me of the plot and what it was and what happened in the story. And there was this one quote about, and I think it applies to this sort of Apple, Disney, whatever sort of innovative education thing that we want to do, because innovation is all about like creativity, would you say? I mean, would, right?
Yeah.
And completely. So there's this quote from the book. It's from Mrs. What's it? She says, life with its rules, its obligations and its freedoms is like a sonnet. You're given the form, but you have to write the sonnet yourself. And so what they were saying in the podcast, and I think sort of what I took from it because I remember when I read A Wrinkle in Time, there was like three or four things in the book that really messed with me because I was just like a little kid and I was like, this is a new way of thinking about things. Like there's these rules for school. Like there's these rules, for instance, for the scientific method. But once you know those rules, like hypothesis, experiment, data, results, conclusions, once you really understand the rules, you're given the form, but you have to write it yourself. Like you have to go back and look at this lab and really write it yourself. And once you know the rules, you're not necessarily bound by the rules anymore. Because you can be creative with the rules, but you have to know the rules in the first place,
right,
to be able to change the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, you can't without the foundation. You just can't do it.
Yeah, and I mean that kind of harkens back to what we were talking about. I don't know if it was two episodes ago or three episodes ago with critical thinking versus content knowledge, and I think you need both. But I think that like if you want to break the rules, you definitely need to know the rules first in order to know what you're breaking and to be sort of thoughtful about how you're going to break them. And because often when people break rules, especially in English class, they're breaking it for a very specific reason, and it's cool, it's awesome, and it's creative. But we have to teach them the rules in order so that they can be thoughtful and perceptive about how they're going to break the rules, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's also a quote from Bushnell's book. He's the guy, the founder of Atari, who's that's the video we were referencing earlier. And in the book, he's supposedly, I don't know if this is a real conversation, because there's no way to verify this now that Steve Jobs is no longer with us. But part of the book that he wrote is called How to Find the Next Steve Jobs, How to Find, Hire, Keep, and Nurture Creative Talent. So he says, around this time, Steve started to regard the computer as the equivalent of a bicycle for our minds, he said. If you look at the fastest animals, human beings aren't among them, he said, unless you give them a bicycle and they can win the race. He says the city's architecture, and he's referencing they're in Paris. So when he says the city's architecture, he's talking about Paris. He said the city's architecture fascinated him as well. He saw a simplicity and uniformity of design in the buildings. And he's basically talking about a conversation they had while they were in Paris, and that Steve wanted Apple to sort of imitate Paris in the sense that no matter where you go in Paris, you always know that you're in Paris. Do you know what I mean? So like, no matter what, if you're in the Louvre or if you're going to the Arc de Triomphe or whatever, like, you're always in Paris because these people have designed Paris to be Paris. And I just think that's cool. And I like the way that Apple sort of thinks that way, because if you look at an Apple product, whether it's an iPhone, an iPad, a Mac, whatever, like, they don't have that many different things. That they're not like a PC where there's like a million different companies that make PCs, right? They only have like four things, but whenever you see it, you know it's Apple. Uh-huh. And so I think maybe he was, even though he's not with us anymore, maybe I think he was in a sense successful at that sort of creation of uniformity. And I wonder if having that kind of uniformity of culture would also help innovation, because Apple has done a lot, even though they only have a few things out. They really have innovated. People are always trying to catch up to the iPhone, to the iPad, to the level of design in the Mac, you know? And so, uh-huh, I think they have innovated, but within this culture of it's like a paradox. They've innovated, but but the culture is so uniform there, but somehow still they find the next big thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about iPads, I went to a training last weekend, and there was a teacher there. You know how the district is implementing the whole new thing with, oh, every kid's going to have an iPad?
I mean, I've heard that. I've never heard anything official, but yeah, I've heard rumors.
Well, that's one of the pilot schools, the one she's at. And she said that, you know, the kids are very attached to the iPads. It's like their kid. And at the beginning, they were able to take them home, but not anymore. So the kids were mad, right? So that's
they were allowed to take them home, but now they're not allowed to take them home?
At the beginning, and then they found a loophole in the law, in the grant that they got for that, so they cannot take them home anymore.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, the thing she said is that there is so many problems with the iPads just in her class. She said that the kids don't put them down. There's a lot of kids that love to take pictures, so they're always taking pictures of themselves. The problem is that now they're losing a lot of time because, you know, you have to put the iPad down, you have to put it away, and then you have to have an advisor at the beginning of the day and at the end to pick it up and drop it off so it can charge. There's so many iPads that have gotten lost. So in that regards, innovation is coming in, but I think we should have been ready a long time ago so that we don't have the problems we have with it now.
I think that also comes back to S1E1. That's season one, episode one of this show. Like, expectations,
right?
that someone somewhere along the line with this grant didn't sit down and think about all the dependencies of this problem. Like, you have iPads. They have to be charged every day. Are the kids going to take them home? Are we going to think about that in advance? How are we going to deal with the cameras on these iPads? Because are we going to have another Jeff Bliss on our hands? You know what I mean? Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, so like, I'll link to it in the show notes. But because there could be so many problems with that. But the thing is there's so many good things you could do with, if every kid has a camera, there's so many good things you could do with, like, presentations,
right,
PowerPoints. I could think of like two or three things that I'd want to do with iPads if every kid had them in a class, especially for like making presentations. But
that has to do with your creativity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then another problem that she said was that the textbooks are not on the iPad. Because that's a big thing. They want to put all textbooks on the iPad, but for some reason they haven't been able to because of whatever law restricting it.
Maybe we should just, I don't know, do away with textbooks? Just kidding. No, I don't really think that. I 50% think that. I don't really use textbooks in my class, to be honest, but they are a nice fallback to have on days where I need them to just do work out of a book. Like, I try not to do that very often, but I like them to have the textbooks for that reason. But, sure. And it's also good for me as like a resource for the teacher to like read through it before the kid, like, cause I basically have to break down the textbook for them anyways, cause they're not going to sit down and read that book. They don't have, because as people who have listened to this podcast know, we work with students who have special needs. And so like they aren't necessarily going to be at that, I don't know, that grade level to be able to read it anyways.
Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to hear how her school is piling it, and it's not really working. Huh. Because I guess it's that lack of, well, the innovation is there with the iPads, but the lack of innovation from the teacher per se to get creative with it and, you know, go free with it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think it would be great, like, for research, and I think she agreed with that, but the problem was, you know, all the other things that come with it, the kids taking pictures or just a waste of time. They're always going to find a way through websites that are supposed to be blocked by the school. So, yeah.
I think that also goes back to what Brian said. What did he a few episodes ago? He said something about tech breaks and, like, at that time you're just allowed to do whatever you want on the iPad. Maybe have 5 or 10 minutes for that in class. Mm-hmm. Maybe at the end of class. Maybe as a reward if they've done all their work or something. I don't know. Though I'm really starting to dislike rewards. Maybe that could be another show someday. But yeah, I don't know. That's a tough question, like how to deal with technology in the classroom. It's such something that I struggle with too, because it would be nice if, because BYOB, like bring your own, I mean, BYOD, bring your own device. That could be really powerful in school too, if kids could actually use their smartphones in class and to do research and whatnot. Because, like, sometimes their smartphones work better than my old iBook G4s, as they say, that are from like 1990. Well, they're not from the 90s, but they're like from the early 2000s. Oh, Jesus, the early 2000s doesn't seem that long ago to me, but it's like 13 years ago now. Jeez. But so the computer's like 10 years old, and they can literally search for things faster on their phones than they can on my iBook G4s that I have in my room. So
why not be innovative and use the smartphone in the classroom? What's the hesitation?
My hesitation is that they're going to do something else, you know, like mess around on it. But at the same time, like, aren't they going to they mess around with each other anyways by talking or whatever? If you give them a group project, half the kids are going to do it. Well, maybe not half, but like a fourth of the kids are going to do it. Half the kids are going to sort of halfway do it. And then one fourth of them aren't going to do it anyways. So might as well let the kids that are going to do it use their phones, and the kids that aren't going to do it use their phones too. And if they're not doing their work, well, maybe they weren't doing their work in the first place. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Have you ever tried it?
No, I want to try it. Have you ever tried it?
I have.
How did it go for you?
Well, the way I did it was, the episode with Brian, he talked about Socrative.
Yeah.
Socrative. And the way that works is they give you a class number and you log it in through your phone. Let's say the kids log it in through their phone. And it'll tell you how many kids are logged on. So as soon as you close the app, it logs you off, like if you're texting, right? So you'll know that not everybody's with you because they're on their phone.
Yeah.
It's really difficult because not all the kids want to do it. Or they use the excuse, no, my phone doesn't have internet.
Yeah, I see.
But I think when I tried it, I've tried it very little because of all those excuses. But I think that just giving the kids that opportunity to use their phone is kind of like validating.
Yeah.
Okay, I know you really want to use it, so let's use it this way. And I guess it kind of gets them, but I can see it kind of going sour at the end because they're going to say, oh, God, now we're going to have to use our phones for this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think one way to get around the excuses of like, oh, well, my phone doesn't use internet is to give them an interest inventory at the beginning of the year. You know how sometimes we do those interest inventories?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And one of the questions could be, does your phone have internet access, and could you use it at school? Like, would it be okay if you use it at school or whatever? Like, do you have enough data or whatever to use it at school? And that way you have in writing that they said that they do have internet on their phone or something. They'll probably still deny it. They'll say like, oh, I got a new phone or blah, blah, blah. But that's at least one way to keep track. And then maybe for the kids that can't use it on their phones, maybe they could use the browser version on one of the computers.
Yeah.
And maybe they could, I don't know, split up and do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So good questions.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting. It can get difficult though.
Yeah.
Especially since, you know, our district especially is so much behind in the use of technology as an innovative instrument.
Yeah. Which takes us back kind of to the original video we were talking about, which is in the show notes, about with the founder of Atari, Nolan Bushnell, I believe is his name.
Uh-huh.
That's a funny last name, Bushnell. Anyways, but he was talking about and interested in changing education sort of into a video game.
Uh-huh.
Because, and I'm thinking back to the year of 1996 when I first went to the now defunct Montgomery Ward. Did you ever go to Montgomery Ward?
Yeah, I did.
And they had me and my brother, well, actually Brian, who was on the podcast before, we saved up our money for about, I don't know, 55 weeks or so of our $2 allowance or whatever it was. And we bought the first Super Nintendo Entertainment System, and we bought the game Donkey Kong Country. And I remember that because it's one of the first video games I ever owned, like for myself. Besides, like when I was younger, I didn't appreciate it as much because, like, my grandma bought me the original Nintendo Entertainment System with like the Mario Brothers and all that stuff. And yeah, I played that. Actually, my dad played it more than I did. But, the Super Nintendo was the first one that I really put a lot of investment into and like saved my money to buy it and all this stuff. And I have three basic questions back from that I remember from 1996. And the three basic questions are, do you know how many times I failed at that game, like losing levels, game over, whatever? Second question, do you know how many hours I played that game? And third question, do you know how much I invested in that game? Like, I mean, as far as like my personal, like not money wise, but just like invest, like I put myself into that game. And so I think that on the one hand, if you want to make education into sort of like a video game, it could be interesting to answer those three questions for like education. Like, how do we get students to fail and still want to come back and play the game of whatever it is that we're trying to teach? Secondly, how do we get them to devote countless hours to our classes the same way? And also like the stipulation of kind of looking back fondly on it, the way that I look back at that game, and not as just some dreaded chore that you have to do. And third, how do we get students to invest in the game, like invest their time, their energy, their resources, and want to actually play the game? I don't know. So like the first question I think is almost the most important one is, how do we get them to fail and still come back? Like, how do we get them to see that he did something wrong and then come back and redo it? I don't know. What do you think?
Commit to a really, really, really good video game.
So, because we have to like mitigate for failures, but we also have to try, like we don't want them to fail all the time, but we also want them to get out there and try things. And if they do fail, to sort of get them back up again and try again, so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't know. I had this weird idea that what if we, I don't know, this might sound dumb, but what if we awarded points even if they did something incorrectly? Like, let's say they do the math problem wrong. Instead of saying, oh, you're wrong, say, oh, you tried it, so I'm going to give you a point. I'm going to give you blah, 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 whatever, and now go try it again. But see, like, the problem is that the way we weight grades doesn't bode well for failing, because somehow we always have to either take off points or blah, 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 or something, something, something. So, like, failure in education almost always means you're docked points on some level. And so, similar to what you were saying about the cell phones, sometimes I wonder if we should just get rid of points in education and just move to more of, like, a narrative feedback kind of thing, where, like, where we're giving them feedback narratively, like, here's what you did well, here's what you didn't do well, redo it, there's no grade on it, just redo it. And then the problem is ultimately at the end of the semester, what do you have to give them? You know, you have to give them a letter grade that is usually based on points, is what they're used to. And so to try to come up with any other kind of system where we sort of try to account for failure and try to help them not to fail, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I'm gonna go back a little bit, and I'm gonna kind of play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
But have you noticed that with the introduction of more video games or things like that, attention problems have become bigger?
Well, I never really knew education before video games, so I can't say that it got bigger. But I would say, and this is probably nostalgia talking, but I would say that when I was in school, it seemed like there was not as many distractions because I was not on Twitter. I was not on Facebook. I was not on any of these things. If I wanted to talk to my friend, I picked up a phone, not a cell phone. I picked up my house phone and called them. Like if I had a girlfriend in high school, I called them on the phone and get this, their parents answered the phone and I had to ask politely to talk to her. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah. It's just, everything's changed. And I don't know that, like, I don't know if attention's gotten better or worse, but they definitely need more stimulation to be interested in something.
Right. And I think it all has to do with the introduction of television. Cause I mean, all the kids today are in their house or on their phone, texting or watching TV or playing video games.
Yeah.
So I think with the introduction of video game as a tool for education, it can be good. But just using video game to educate, I think that might be. It's, you know, it'll address the need now.
Yeah.
But will we be creating more of visual learners instead of auditory learners?
Yeah. I mean,
that's my thing, you know, like, okay, I mean, I understand that, yeah, kids are more visual, they need visual input, they need more input than they give, they need more input than they give output, but at some point, they're going to have a job, and their boss is not going to draw a picture for them and say, this is what I want you to do.
Yeah,
it's gonna be an auditory thing, you know, it's going to be, this is what I want you to do, and if they can't process that information auditorily, then they're kind of screwed.
Yeah. Like, they're not always going to have that visual.
Yeah, they're not going to have a video game to teach them how to do something.
Yeah. Well, they might, but yeah. But it, I think your point comes back to the second question, which was, how do we get them to put in the hours? Because it, honestly, like you were saying, we're competing with Microsoft, Apple, Disneyland. Well, Apple and Disneyland, like we already talked about, but HBO, we're competing with video game developers. And it's like, it's their, like, for video game developers, their entire job is just to create something interesting and entertaining for them. They're not bound by, like, standards or anything like that. Like, they're just trying to create the most interesting, entertaining game to keep them playing for hours. Right. And, like, we only have 1/8 of that time because seven eighths, I don't know if that's a good analogy, but 7/8 of our time is devoted to teaching and, like, we have 1/8 of that time to create our quote unquote products, like lesson plans. And so how do we get them to invest in our lesson plans when we don't have the time or even necessarily the resources to compete with something of like that amount of, I don't know, stimulation.
Mm-hmm. Well, another question that I just thought about right now is, well, what are the games that our students are interested in right now? And it's more of those, oh, Modern Warfare 3, let's go shoot this guy, let's
Gold
go shoot
edition.
That, right?
Fighting so, the aliens.
So, I mean, is that how we're going to educate kids with guns?
Exactly.
I don't know, because how interesting is a game about, for example, phagocytes going to be?
Yeah.
Oh, let's write a sentence together. Come on. I don't know how interesting that's going to be.
And I told Sarah this last week, I need to do like a whole episode on why this is not maybe for this podcast, but a whole episode on why warfare may not be the best analogy for biological processes. Because every time I read that book, that our biology book, our textbook, it's always like, or like if there's videos that I want to show, they're always like very much like, and the phagocytes attack the pathogens and destroy them with their blah blah blah. And it's just like if they made a video game out of it, the kids would be more interesting in like destroying the pathogens or with their cool weapon, their cool weapon T cells, and they would start thinking of everything as a weapon. And I don't know that that's the best way to leave high school, is to think that everything is like sort of this farcical war that you have to fight. Because I do tend to think that video games are built on conflict. And I don't know, this is something that I'm just thinking about right now, so if it sounds dumb, sorry. But like, video games are built on conflict, and education and learning and concepts, they're not, sometimes they're built on conflict, especially in a history class, but a lot of times, like, these are just things that you need to learn and think about and digest. And there is room for like debate, but it needs to be within a certain context. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So like, I'm not sure that I like the idea of video, because I am honestly like you, I'm very skeptical of all the things that he said in that video.
I think it would be a tool, but not the only means.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, if we're just going to use video games, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, go learn how to write a complete sentence using this video game. And, you know, that's not going to be interesting for them. That's not going to be the input that they need.
Yeah.
But I'm not, I mean, that's not to say that they do get the input that they need in the classroom.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of that. I'm speechless, but I agree. Like, it's just, I think there's just so many more problems that open up as a result of video games than I'm not sure that the amount of problems it opens up solves the amount of things that it's supposed to solve. I wonder if it's about 50-50, like the amount of problems it opens versus the amount of problems it solves. And I don't know that video games are the way to go. Maybe if we called it something different and it was like a video game, but I think we would need more time to think about it.
Yeah, but I think we would need to see it. See how it really works.
Yeah.
I mean right now we're saying it because that's what we think, but you know, if let's say it was awesome, it was teaching them, then I think we would probably change our mind. But I mean, we haven't seen it, and from what we know about video games, which is a lot compared to me, very little, it might not be what we want.
Yeah,
but it might be what they need.
Yeah, and it ultimately comes back to the idea of investment. How are we going to get kids invested in such and such topic or content? Like, we tried hashtags, and it worked okay, you know? But we have to be careful that we're not just like, for instance, since we're talking about social media, I guess I'll just use social media as the example, but hang on. Sorry. But like, we shouldn't just use social media for the sake of social media. It needs to be something where, like, somehow this social media or this whatever it is that we're going to XYZ thing that we're going to use in class needs to be able to create some kind of value intrinsically for these kids that makes them want to complete the assignment. And it needs to be based on sort of the cultural economy of the school where, like, whatever it is that you're doing, they find it valuable and the school finds it valuable. You know, I think that's the big thing, is that kids find video games valuable. They go online, they play them with their friends. They like to see who's the best, blah, blah, blah. They've created this whole sort of subculture of video games, and we somehow need to harness that same thing without. And that's what I mean, is I don't think we necessarily need to copy video games, which is where I think the Atari guy may go a little bit wrong, is we don't necessarily need to copy video games, but we need to have something that is that stimulating,
mm-hmm.
but also stimulates learning,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so, because for those of you who haven't watched the video, Nolan Bushnell talks about how he thinks that he could do things 10 times as fast with a video game. And I find that really interesting, and I'm wondering how he thinks he can do that. I don't know that I agree with that. Like, I agree with his idea that there are some students who don't fit the model. He said that there are some students that don't fit the model of a good student, but they're still really creative and really smart. And we need to have a conversation about how to get those kids engaged. Last night, for instance, there was this thing on Twitter. I've been trying to get more on the Twitter to try and use it because, and there was this thing called GT chat, and they had like a little hashtag GT chat, and they, it's a reference to gifted and talented students, and they were talking about how to advocate for them. And I think that video games is sort of a good way to advocate for kids like that, who like to learn on their own, who can learn faster. But I'm also suspicious of the idea at the same time, because not all students are going to be able to work at that same pace. Although he does think that it can be adaptive, which that would be interesting, don't you think, if a video game adapted to how fast they worked and like every kid gets through it, but maybe just some kids do it slower. It
sounds like a smart video game to me.
Yeah. And the problem, though, is that the question is then how slow is too slow? Because then you're sort of blurring the lines of grade level, because then like, okay, this kid is at this level, so should he not be doing these standards? How adaptive is adaptive? That's the question that becomes the problem, is that we do have standards, and it, and whether or not you like standards or is another thing, but like they have to meet these certain standards to be considered a 10th grader or a 9th grader. And I know the elementary and middle school, they socially promote them because they have to, but like at high school, like you have to meet certain proficiencies to graduate. And I don't know that if it's too adaptive, I wonder if some kids would get really far behind.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it'd be the same thing though, because they already are behind.
They already are behind. Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, to me, I don't know, maybe it's using creativity to kind of stifle it.
What, you know,
because if I use a video game, I'm using the, like, for example, this Nolan guy is using his creativity to educate students, but at the same time, he's stifling their creativity because the video game is going to be very directed. You know, this is what you need to do, and if you don't do it this way, that's the wrong way.
Yeah, and it goes back to the Khan Academy debate of like, is it okay to just show kids videos and then have them do work it's like this idea of the flipped classroom, where like, is it okay to just send kids home and watch videos and learn the material that way, and then in class just have them independently do work and then come around and help them as they need it? Like, is that a good way to teach? And I don't think, especially for students that have needs like ours, I don't know that just sending them home and say, okay, go ahead and eat the cake at home and then come back and do all this work, I don't know that that's going to work for every kid. I think some kids need a different way. And I know that they're going to say, oh, well, the video game will do it lots of different ways. But I tend to think that all they're going to do is like break it. Instead of like calling, I think when they say different ways, I sometimes wonder if they mean, they're just going to break it down more. You don't know how to do 2 times. You don't know how to do 2 times 8. Well, let's go back to addition. Oh, you don't know how to do addition. Well, let's go back to this visual thing. Oh, you don't know how to do the visual thing. Well, let's go back to blah, blah, blah. And they're just going to keep working back into, and I just have this feeling that video games are going to be this sort of uncreative way. And it's just going to be going back and back and back and back. And I think sometimes you just need a teacher there to directly instruct someone and show them how to do it.
Yeah.
And if they're not getting it, the teacher can see that and adjust. And I don't know that they're, I'm sure someday there will be a computer that can do that, but right now that's not really a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the, yeah, that's, I agree. It's a, it's not, I don't know. I don't think it's going to work if that's the only tool you use. If you use it as, you know, something like, to help you get to it,
then
that might work. But if you only use a video game and that's the only thing that you're going to use to teach the child, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
If you use it like, okay, so let's say, for example, you're I don't know if you're still doing phagocytes, but if you're teaching them about that and, you know, you see that they're getting it, you can use that so that they can understand it more, and they have that visual representation, but you're not gonna use it in order to initially, teach them about genetics, you know?
Yeah.
Because I mean, it's two different things, but it's not, I don't know, it doesn't sound realistic.
And this might be like tangential to the whole discussion, but Bushnell, Nolan Bushnell, as they say, he basically argued that the content is the food stuff or like the raw materials for creative thought. And that goes back to, again, S1E4. Is that the one that we talked about, content? I don't know. Anyways, but it goes back to the idea of content versus critical thinking and that the two strands may be more related than we think. Uh-huh. But at the same time, to think of the content as just like the raw materials to do something else, that goes back to what me and Sarah were talking about last week, where like we're always just trying to get them further and further along in this curriculum. And we're always sort of like looking ahead. And we're never just sitting down and looking at, right now, here in this place, do you understand this one thing? And are you as a teacher passionate, or at least fake passionate, about that one thing that you're trying to get across at that one moment, and not worrying about this whole arc I don't know that a computer can get that across in the same way. I'm not saying that they never will be able to. There's this whole video on YouTube called Digital Aristotle. I'll put a link to it, by CGP Grey, where he does think that someday we will have computers that can do what we do. But until that time, well, even if they could, I'm not sure that I'd want them, computers, to be able to do that, because it is a uniquely kind of human thing to be able to, in the moment, be passionate about this one thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, so going back to the article that you said, the 5 steps to create a progressive student-centered classroom, the one that you sent me through that link, you know, I was looking at it, and I think it's interesting how, for them, because I guess it is about innovation, it's creating projects, integrating technology, not just using technology as the only thing, using in-class activities more than homework, eliminating rules and consequences, and just letting kids know that the learning environment is built on mutual respect and college, so there won't be any time for behavior issues, and involving the students. You know, I think that as an educator, that'd be awesome, more than a video game.
I think we should save the article for its own thing, because I think that, let me tell you, let's give them a little teaser. But after I read the article, I actually last night I went and looked at, I clicked on his on the author page, and he wrote a book called Role Reversal, Achieving Uncommon something something something. Anyways, but his name's Mark Barnes, as in
Mark,
like
Barnes, yeah.
Barnes as in like a barn in the
Barnes and Noble.
but I think he lives in a barn too. No, I'm just kidding. He goes into more depth about it, and I'm just gonna give people a little taste of it. He quotes this book called Why Managing Sucks and How to Fix It. It's written by these two ladies who used to be CEOs at what's the place with all the computers called? The big store. Not Worst Buy. Oh, Best Buy. they managed it, and they came up with this idea called results only work. Somehow the initials spell row, R-O-W-E. And he came up with the idea. He changed the W to an L because it's school. So it's results only learning education or something like that. And
results only learning environment.
Yeah, that's what it is. He came up with this idea, and it's this idea that like, it doesn't, like, if a kid's absent 10 times during the semester, he's like, that shouldn't matter. What should matter is whether or not they complete the assignments. And in his class, kind of what we talked about, I kind of alluded to it earlier, he doesn't use points in his class. It's crazy to me. It's crazy to me that he doesn't use points. I don't know how he does it. But apparently at the end of the semester, he goes over, they look over all the narrative feedback that he's given that particular student. And he says, what grade do you think you deserve?